Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original.
I'm Steve Kathan. Secretary of State Blinken has postponed next week's planned diplomatic trip to China. It comes after a suspected Chinese spy balloon was seen over Montana. It's now high over the Midwest.
U.S. officials say the balloon is traveling at an altitude of 66,000 feet and maneuvering as it is blown on a trajectory that is expected to take it across the United States. The Pentagon continues to track it on radar and at times has it under visual observation. Military officials have recommended against shooting it down for now because of the danger it would pose to people on the ground. But officials say that recommendation could change once the balloon gets over an unpopulated area. David Martin, CBS News, Washington.
China insists it's a civilian research balloon and has expressed regrets. The government says employers added 517,000 jobs last month. CBS's Jill Schlesinger says that's considered a strong number.
The January jobs report underscores the message that Jerome Powell gave during his press conference this week. Although economic growth is weakening, the labor market remains resilient, which means the Fed is likely to continue raising interest rates maybe two more times at a quarter point each so that wage growth starts to come down and inflation readings improve.
Wind chills this morning in the upper Midwest were in the 25 below zero range. WCBS meteorologist Craig Allen says the brutal cold is now pushed east.
The winds continue to increase. They'll be running at gale force, running 20 to 30 and gusting over 40 miles per hour at times through the day today. And the temperature and wind combination will keep driving the wind chill down until it reaches dangerously low levels, anywhere from minus 10 to as low as minus 40 or minus 50.
Honda and the government are urging owners of thousands of older vehicles not to drive them until dangerous airbag inflators are replaced. Here's Jeff Gilbert of Detroit affiliate WWJ.
These are older 01 to 03 Hondas and Acuras with non-repaired Takata airbags. Honda says there are 8,200 vehicles out there that have a high risk of having the airbag inflator rupture that can cause death or serious injury. You can check with a dealer or the NHTSA.gov recall database.
A Republican bill in Arizona would restrict drag shows in the state.
It's not R-rated, it's X-rated entertainment.
GOP Senator John Kavanaugh says under the bill, performances would be banned near daycare centers, schools, and churches. Performer Jessica Harper spoke in opposition.
This bill is so vaguely written that it would effectively make it illegal for me to exist in public as a trans woman, let alone DJ anywhere but a strip club.
Checking Wall Street right now, a mixed bag. The Dow is up 57 points. The S&P is down 5. This is CBS News.
A progressive voice for rural Wisconsin. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The federal infrastructure law has been in effect for a year now. Community leaders around Wisconsin are optimistic about badly needed repairs and improvements. Here's Mike Moen.
At the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, Zach Brewing says so far nearly $3 billion in projects have been announced with funding from the law. Most are transportation related, and Brewing says it's badly needed as many areas have backlogs for priorities like road and bridge repairs.
And so by having a real strong federal partnership in the area of infrastructure helps address some of the backlog.
The law will also provide states funding for clean water infrastructure and expansion of high-speed internet. The plan did have some Republican opposition, but has otherwise been hailed by political analysts as a bipartisan achievement. Despite the significance of the law, some of those analysts say it hasn't stayed on the public's radar, especially during the recent election. But supporters are still getting the word out. Megan Rowe is with Opportunity Wisconsin, which has spent the last year educating communities about the benefits of these projects.
Whether we're spending less on car repairs due to updated roads and bridges, having access to safe drinking water or improved mass transit opportunities, this law is a once-in-a-generation investment in our state's infrastructure and competitiveness.
And as more projects are announced, Rowe says it means additional well-paid union jobs for distressed areas. She says the long-term benefits from various improvements should particularly help rural areas and underserved communities. An interactive online map from the White House shows the projects so far are spread fairly evenly across Wisconsin. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Do your priorities for the country match the president's? Listen live as Joe Biden lays out his plans during the State of the Union address February 7th, starting at 8 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station. Then stay with us as News Director Terry Bell and guests break down and share reaction to the policies the president presents. You can join the conversation too. The State of the Union address live with coverage from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesday, February 7th on your local Civic Media radio station, streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
The Shaw 101 FM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24-7 at waukradio.com.
Morning Cannolis with James Centel is an independent product and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
And good morning. This is our weekend review, our analysis, and our discussion of the most important stories in law, in government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me once again on this bright and bold Saturday morning, February 4th, 2023, in the United States of America. This is a broadcast of Civic Media. We're coming to you from the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. It's The Shot, 540 AM, 101 FM. And in this hour, our 9 o'clock hour, and in the next hour as well. As always, we're going to be taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. I am joined, as I am always on these Saturday morning occasions, by my wonderful professional producer, Calvin. And he and I will take your phone calls, your comments, your perspectives on all of these important issues that, yes, once again, we're going to be talking about this morning. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for joining Calvin and all of the broadcast places of Civic Media statewide. We do, as always, have an ambitious but achievable agenda, a syllabus for this morning's discussion. It should be both informative and hopefully even somewhat inspiring in terms of the things that we as United States citizens, as citizens of the state of Wisconsin, should be doing to ensure the future of the rule of law in the places that we live, the places that we work, and the places that we grow and develop on every single day of our lives. This morning, as always, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the past, recognizing some important things that happened today in history, February 4th, of historical pieces, historical dates in our past. And in particular, we're going to be spending a little bit of time talking about something that happened 20 years ago tomorrow on February 5th, talking about that as well. And then our agenda does include a wide-ranging set of topics, again, in the areas of law and justice, the aspiration for the rule of law in America. We're going to begin by talking about the Fourth Amendment this morning and some perspectives on search warrants this morning, both those that we have chatted about at great length in the past, having to do with the search warrant at the Mar-a-Lago residence of the former president way back in August of last year, and more recently, the searches of the residences and one of the businesses of the present president, Joe Biden. We spent some time talking about civics this morning, a little bit of criminal constitutional law, some investigative law. Under the Fourth Amendment, what is the difference between a search warrant that is authorized by a federal magistrate judge or a district court judge and what we have seen more recently with respect to consent reviews and consent searches of properties, including those of the present president? We'll talk about that a little bit. And then beyond that, we've got at least four, if not five, major stories from different areas of life and of law throughout the state of Wisconsin and the United States of America. We're going to talk about a major ruling coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals having to do with the unconstitutionality of a federal criminal statute regarding the possession, the use, the carrying of firearms. It's making a lot of news coming out of one of our appeals courts We're also going to be chatting again about some January 6th charges and a conviction recently had in a federal district court in Washington, D.C. And then moving all around the country, this past week we saw the release of a Guantanamo Bay defendant, a terrorist who was held in custody at Guantanamo Bay for many years and now released, going to be going to Belize. We'll chat about that. Then we're going to come back to Wisconsin and talk about Kyle Rittenhouse. Kyle Rittenhouse and a wrongful death action that a federal district court judge in Milwaukee, the Eastern District of Wisconsin, recently said can go ahead against him for the deaths in connection with Kyle Rittenhouse's shootings, as we all well recall. And finally, also talking, going back to the East Coast, about Johnson & Johnson and a recent Third Circuit Court of Appeals case basically said that major corporations cannot hide behind the bankruptcy laws and the rules as a way of avoiding the imposition of significant civil judgments if, in fact, they're found responsible for pharmaceuticals and other negligence in the marketplace of America. Lots of different things to talk about this morning, but let us begin, as I said, with a little bit of reference to the past, some things that happened today in history. All of these, interestingly, have some connection to the rule of law and to the administration of justice in the past and also in the present, right here in the United States of America. Today, February 4th, 1945, World War II was coming to an end. This was the first day of the Yalta Conference. Students of history, those of you who are not students of history but know this, recognize that this was the start at the Yalta Conference of this very important meeting among the leaders: Franklin Delano Roosevelt, United States of America, obviously Winston Churchill, the United Kingdom, and Joseph Stalin of Russia at the time, and all of them getting together to talk about what's going to happen in the post-World War II world, a plan for the final defeat and the occupation of Nazi Germany. I'm beginning to talk about some line drawing, other things that happened in the wake of World War II. The first day of that Yalta Conference today, February 4th, 1945, to talk, as I indicated, about another connection to war, this one, the war on terrorism, as we talk about this Guantanamo Bay defendant a bit later in our two-hour program this morning. Also today, 1974, another major matter, a major news item that attracted not only the attention of lawyers and judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and investigators, but of all of us. 1974, February 4th of 1974, was the date that newspaper heiress Patty Hearst was kidnapped by a group called the Symbionese Liberation Army. Those of you who were around at that time recall that name well, the SLA. She later appeared in two bank robberies with that group. She was known at the time then as Tanya. An awful lot of people believe, as she confirmed later on, effectively brainwashed, indoctrinated into the views of this group and became one of them, if you will. A lot of focus on whether or not she was engaging those bank robberies voluntarily or if she was coerced. In the end, she was captured by the FBI in 1975, prosecuted by the federal government in 1976 based upon those bank robberies, some firearms offenses, and served some time, about 3 years of a seven-year sentence in federal prison. Interestingly, Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence during the course of his time as president. We have talked a lot on this broadcast about the prerogative of chief executives to issue pardons under the United States Constitution. And then Bill Clinton, during the course of his term as president, issued a full pardon to Patty Hearst, again, during his time as president of the United States of America. So all that happening, 1974, 1975, 1976, obviously into Jimmy Carter's term and Bill Clinton's term as well. Again, a major story at that time continues to reverberate to this day when it comes to notions of indoctrination and the ways in which people can, in fact, be brainwashed, if you will, into believing things that are not true. And we're going to chat a little bit about that in connection with a case pending before the Supreme Court down the road and also perhaps today as well. And finally, today in 2004 was a day that something happened that changed forever the landscape, the way in which we communicate with each other, in which we communicate with people we do not even know. This was the day that a website called thefacebook.com was launched by people like Mark Zuckerberg and his colleagues in college at university at the time. It became, of course, the largest social network in the world. And again, raising some questions today about the extent to which providers of online websites and online platforms for discussion of issues, for presentation of ideas, should in fact be held liable for the things that their clients, the people who make use of those platforms, post. A major case pending before the Supreme Court right now on that issue. That language in a statute that gives removes liability for platform providers is now subject to review by the Supreme Court. So it could very much change not only our understanding of Facebook, but many other platform providers like TikTok and others out there that have provided those kinds of forums for discussion. We'll talk about that down the road as well. I mentioned before that we're going to spend a little bit of time this morning, a bit of commentary from me as well, about something that happened 20 years ago tomorrow, February 5th, 20 years ago tomorrow, 2003, and February 5th. This was a day that a Secretary of State, his name was Colin Powell in the George Bush administration, appeared in front of the Security Council of the United Nations. And why was he there? He was talking about a rule of law issue. And in particular, he was providing information that we know in the end was inaccurate, was false, was premised upon inaccurate intelligence, but he represented to the Security Council, to the United Nations, to the world, what? He represented that a fellow named Saddam Hussein, who was at that time the autocratic leader of Iraq, held weapons of mass destruction. Talked about that 17 different times during the course of about an hour-long presentation, obviously trying to encourage the world platform, nations around our planet, to believe that this was true. Colin Powell said that there was hard and credible evidence, not only based upon pictures that he showed, but also some tapes that he played about conversations, that the autocratic leader, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, posed a real threat to the safety and security of the nation, of the world. And, of course, we know in the wake of that 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 was all simply not true. Later on, Colin Powell came back and said he regretted that, but he was relying upon reliable, what he thought was reliable, security and intelligence information. I raise that today not only because it was 20 years ago tomorrow that that was said, obviously changing forever our own history in America, the history of the world, gave George Bush the cover, if you will, the information base, if you will, even though inaccurate, to invade Iraq. Many of you know that I spent 2 years in Iraq, 2006 to 2008, long after we had invaded, long after we had toppled Saddam Hussein. And the reason that I went there at the time was because I volunteered as a part of an initiative of the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of State. And the purpose of that was, in the middle of the war, while the war was continuing with respect to all sorts of entities there, trying to establish the rule of law there, working a lot with courts and judges, prisons and police officers, establishing the rule of law. I served as the rule of law coordinator, the justice attaché, and did that again in a volunteer capacity, raising my hand to do it, supported tremendously by, of course, the United States of America, even in the wake of a mistake made, nonetheless, a decision to go over there to try to make good on something. And I'm going to talk more about that right after our first brief break here. Come back right here on Morning Cannolis, chatting more about that event 20 years ago tomorrow.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
I'm Pat Kreitlow from Up North News. On an earlier edition, we talked to three women, med students, about whether they're going to stay in Wisconsin to practice medicine.
All this Roe v. Wade stuff, and now OBGYN's hands are so tied. I don't want to go through 12 years of training to have some person that didn't do training tell me how to do my job.
It is not a binary choice. You're for or against abortion. It is a healthcare decision. We all have those stories, and people want to hear them.
Don't miss the real stories here on Up North News.
I'm looking at the phone lines. I'm seeing some familiar faces. Wants to remind a Gina Beauclair.
Well, welcome back, Matt. I really miss you. We've been missing getting woke every morning, but now we'll get woke in the afternoon.
Wants to remind a Andrew of Detroit.
Professor, it's so nice you're back. We missed you during your vacation, and I'm very happy to be in your class for the semester.
Thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate all my callers.
Tune in to Matt Flynn Direct, Monday through Friday, 3 to 4 p.m.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Cloudy skies with a few peaks of sun this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 34. Southwest winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. Overcast tonight, lows level off around 27. Cloudy skies expected tomorrow, highs level off around 34. Dry with temperatures a bit above average Monday and Tuesday, and highs in the upper 30s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 16 degrees.
Bringing some sanity to the airwaves. The Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
This is our weekly, our Saturday morning analysis, our review, our discussion of some of the major issues in law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you once again for joining me and my producer, Calvin, here on this Civic Media station. We're accepting your calls, as always, taking your calls, welcoming your calls at 844-967-2789. And right before our first brief break this morning, I was chatting about something that happened 20 years ago tomorrow, February 5th. This proclamation by our former Secretary of State named Colin Powell, who advised the world, confirmed for the world wrongly at the time, that Saddam Hussein in Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, credible evidence of that. Later on, plainly determined that that was not the case. And right before the break, I was chatting about my own involvement in that rule of law issue, which is that in late 2005, I volunteered at the request of the Department of Justice at that time. They were looking for people who'd go to Iraq and try to make a go of the rule of law entities, that is, the prisoners and those who are in incarcerative situations there and in the prisons there. Also working with police, law enforcement to ensure that the integrity of those systems are in place, and especially focusing on courts, process, procedure, the kinds of things that we perhaps take for granted here in the United States of America, always can use improvements and further perfections. At the time, along with a number of other assistant U.S. attorneys, I volunteered to go to Iraq to spend what turned out to be 2 years, 2006-2008, in the middle of that war, and did what one of the ambassadors at that time said, Ryan Crocker, a man for whom I have great admiration, said this is sort of like doing the Marshall Plan in Poland in 1942. The war is still underway, trying to do this reconstruction, this rehabilitation. And although in any enterprise like that, when you go into a war-torn and war-ravaged country, anytime you're doing that kind of activity, great challenges, both in terms of transportation, other issues like that, trying to accomplish things, training, advancement, support of those rule of law tenants, again, prisons and police and courts. Nonetheless, I will tell you that I'm very proud of the work that many of us did at that time. A small handful from the Department of Justice serving as resident legal advisors at various places around the nation. Again, I served as the rule of law coordinator and the justice attaché, working with the State Department, with the Defense Department as well, in trying to promote justice in Iraq. And although the results on that are still very much out, one could make the same argument about the United States of America, that even after our 240 years, the report card is not yet written. Plainly, Iraq continues to be a place of some great instability. There are still places of violence. But today, not because of the things that I did or others individually did, but because of the overall attempts to try to make a go of a situation that was admittedly prompted by bad information, by a wrong advice being given. Today in Iraq, it is a republic, and there is a parliament, there is a prime minister, there are presidents of various areas, there are secretaries. Is it a perfect democratic union? No, it is not, plainly. Still many great challenges there. But again, very proud of the efforts that we made, along with a number of others, to try to instill the rule of law and that sense of justice, things we talk about here on this broadcast every day for about 2 years, 2006, 2008. And so I recall both the wrong decision to go in, and also I would like to thank the investment that the United States made in establishing what is a nation today that is a republic where people are voting. And there is some sense, fledgling perhaps, and insecure perhaps, but nonetheless, a nation that is no longer run by an autocrat. I know that those kinds of issues can be very controversial. Lots of good discussion about those kinds of things all the time. And coming back to our nation as well, we have a constitution as well, as does Iraq. Our constitution, of course, the oldest one on the face of the planet, also one of the shortest ones on the face of the planet. And it includes a Fourth Amendment that was passed by our first Congress after the acceptance, after the approval by the requisite number of states, and includes a Fourth Amendment that establishes many things, but among other provisions that are that establish the rights and the prerogatives and the positions of all citizens of the United States, this right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. That's the language that James Madison and George Mason and others wrote into our Constitution as a part of the first amendments to that Constitution. I spent some time talking about search warrants this morning because, once again, they've been in the news this past week. Let's focus first upon that news. We know that from just this past Wednesday that the Federal Bureau of Investigation conducted a search at the vacation home of the present president, Joe Biden, in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And that was confirmed by the president's lawyer on Wednesday morning. Investigators of the FBI plainly continuing to look into his possession of classified documents. In previous news, we also know as well that the FBI searched the location of this Penn Biden Center, which was his think tank location after he left the vice presidency in the wake of the Obama administration, and also searched the location of his Wilmington, Delaware home. And all of those searches, you might say, well, gee, was there a magistrate judge? Was there a federal district court judge who issued a search warrant under the Fourth Amendment? And the answer is no, no. And you say, well, how does that happen then? Well, the answer is that under the Fourth Amendment and under the rules and regulations, the interpretations of that have followed, there's also something called a consent search, And that is that if the investigators of the state, local, federal authorities come to my door and ask, can we search your property? Can we search your office? And I give them consent. Usually today it's written down to establish it so that when the lawyers and the judges get a hold of that down the road, they've got confirmation. But that was what was done in this case. A consent search does not necessarily have to be supported by probable cause. Simply has to be a request made by the government to come in and take a look, see if there are documents that would suggest that they should not be there. And we know that in some locations, obviously, there was the finding of some documents. At the Rehoboth Beach location, they did not find any new documents. I'm going to talk more about this concept of a consent search, which was the focus of these searches of the present president's locations, and the difference between that and a search warrant issued by a federal magistrate judge with respect to the residence of the former president, Mar-a-Lago, back in August. Stay with us for that discussion.
The SHA 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee, always streaming at WAUKradio.com.
CBS News Brief. There's word a suspected Chinese spy balloon is now high over the Midwest. Pentagon correspondent David Martin.
Military officials have recommended against shooting it down, but officials say that recommendation could change once the balloon gets over an unpopulated area.
China insists it's a civilian balloon conducting research. The government says employers tacked on 517,000 jobs last month. CBS's Jill Schlesinger.
Although economic growth is weakening, the labor market remains resilient, which means the Fed is likely to continue raising interest rates.
The unemployment rate hit a new half-century low, 3.4%. Forecaster Craig Allen watching a northern deep freeze.
This dangerous chill has the temperatures already well below zero from Minnesota and Wisconsin across the lakes, as well as Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York State, and now moving into New England.
Wind chills dipping below zero. CBS News Brief, I'm Steve Kathan.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
The Devil's Advocates, the fix for political junkies everywhere.
You could nominate your D-bag of the year. Got a nominee for us?
There were so many of them, as we can tell. I had to go with the ranked choice system. Okay.
I like the way you think, Rick. Okay. What else you got?
Rojo.
You know, listener poll. I think this nominee for D-bag of the year pretty much sums it up.
Find Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And also on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
Max Inc. Radio, we are local music with Pete from the Skin Tones.
Here, you have been warned. Not only Madison, the rest of Wisconsin and the U.S., Skin Tones, we're coming at you. We're going to be committing rock atrocities. We're fit. We're in shape. We are tight. We are muscular. We are attractive for our ages. And we are sexy as hell.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio Saturday nights, 6 p.m. to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP. We're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
Oh. We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
We are joined by the 57th Assembly District Representative, Lee Snodgrass. Thanks for being here.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
How do I need to adapt this based on what has changed since I first introduced it? Government does not move fast. I'm sure that's a shocker to all of you guys. Public policy doesn't change until public opinion changes.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Stories come to life at your local parks and forests. They're places of wonder, and they're closer than you think. Make the forest part of your story today at a local park near you, or find one at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United
About searches this morning under the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. Doing some civics this morning on Morning Cannolis, talking about the difference between a consent search, which again is conducted by federal or state or local authorities upon the consent of the person who has a privacy right, a privacy interest in the place, the location to be searched, giving approval, giving authorization, if you will, for law enforcement to come in and do the search that they are requesting to do. And again, not necessarily predicated upon a finding by a magistrate judge, not predicated at all, typically, by finding by a magistrate judge or a federal judge that there is probable cause, that there is evidence of crime in that location, but simply an investigative technique. And if in fact the owner of that property decides that he or she or it wants to rescind that consent, that can always be done. You can take that back and say, you know what, I've decided not to go ahead with it further. That's what the President of the United States of America and his lawyers have done in recent weeks, including just this past week, again, taking our page from the news at this search of the Rehoboth Beach vacation home of the president, finding in the end at that location no additional documents of a classified nature. But the consent search went along. And law enforcement now having visited that location,
locations in Wilmington, Delaware, and also the Penn Biden Center in Washington, D.C., finding some documents, some of those disclosed by his attorneys, others, again, identified by law enforcement as a result of this agreement, this cooperation, if you will, between the president saying, yes, indeed, I want to cooperate with the investigators. I want to ensure that these documents are returned to where they should be and that the investigations of these matters proceed apace, that they proceed upon cooperation with the government. Contrast that approach to what happened last year. Again, over a period of many months last year, these attempts by the NARA, by the National Archives, and ultimately the Department of Justice to obtain from the former president, Donald Trump, what turned out to be thousands of documents, all of them probably not properly within his possession, but well over 100 of them classified in nature. Ultimately, after an unsuccessful attempt to subpoena those documents, to make requests, sort of cordially, if you will, to return those documents, what happened? The U.S. Department of Justice requested of a federal magistrate judge in South Florida for permission to go in and conduct a Fourth Amendment search without cooperation, without that consent that I talked about before. And sure enough, the magistrate judge, as we spoke about this way back in August and other times in the fall, looked at the probable cause to believe that there was evidence of a crime at the location in Mar-a-Lago. He looked at that, as you well know, we talked about the 30 or 40 page affidavit in support of that finding of probable cause. The great majority of that text still not disclosed. Why? Because there's been no criminal prosecution, nothing to disclose there publicly or even to a future defendant. But we know that there was probable cause because a federal magistrate judge said, yes, indeed, there is probable cause, and I'm going to grant you the authority to go in and without consent, without authorization of the owner, the property owner at that point, still to this day, Donald Trump, I'm going to permit you to go in and search that premises by virtue of the authority conveyed by the judiciary, by the court. That's a finding of probable cause. That's what James Madison, George Mason, others contemplated. No unreasonable searches and seizures. That word unreasonable meaning, you can't simply go in and kick the door down. You've got to have the imprimatur of a judge, of a court, who has taken this independent, nonpartisan, nonpolitical look at what you have and made the determination that under the Constitution, there is a basis for doing this. That's what happened. That's the difference between the search warrant conducted way back in early August of last year and these consent searches being done recently, again, by the FBI, same entities, probably conducted in much the same manner, reviewing various locations, taking a look at papers, documenting them, identifying them, providing inventories of them, and certainly taking those documents that should not be in the possession of the current president and, yes, also the former president. But the predicates for those things, as I've indicated, very, very different in terms of how it is that those law enforcement authorities, the FBI in both cases, get in. So that's our civics lesson this morning from the Fourth Amendment annals of law schools and also right here on our Saturday morning show. I'm going to stay in Washington, D.C. to talk about a couple of other significant events that happened just this past week in connection with, yes, once again, January 6th. One involving a newly charged defendant for his involvement in the January 6th insurrection, the riot at our United States Capitol, the attempt to overthrow our government at that time, and also another significant trend that is happening with respect to some, not all, not even a majority of the nearly 1,000 defendants who have been charged and are being convicted, tried, and sentenced for their on-site involvement in what happened on January 6th. Let's start with the first of those two stories. We know, just based upon charges that were issued just this past week, that a retired Chicago fire department firefighter, his name is Joseph Pavlik. He's 65 years old. He was in Chicago. He was arrested on Tuesday on a criminal complaint. It was filed in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. And again, a little civics lesson here. You can, in fact, arrest someone on a federal warrant, even though it comes out of Washington, D.C., where that person is located. That's what happened. We have a federal criminal complaint here charging him with obstruction of law enforcement, knowingly entering restricted grounds, and disorderly conduct. All of those things related to his involvement in the insurrection, the riot of January 6th. U.S. Magistrate Judge Sunil Harjani ordered Pavlik released on bond pending his appearance in the federal district court in Washington, D.C. The Chicago Police Department confirmed on Wednesday that Pavlik had joined the department in 1981 and served as a firefighter there until his retirement in 2013. Now, why is this significant? Well, it's significant because, according to the complaint, that is the information provided in the affidavit in support of this charge against Mr. Pavlik, it makes clear that he is a part of a group called the Three Percenters. We've talked a lot about the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Some of those people, as you well know, have been convicted already, are heading towards sentences probably of a significant nature. Others are still on trial even in these weeks. But this fellow, part of a group called the Three Percenters, and he made various right-wing statements in the weeks leading up to the Capitol attack, claiming that the election of 2020 had been stolen by then-President, President Donald Trump, and calling for violent action. Again, part of the affidavit in support of his complaint. He allegedly said this. He said, "These aren't Americans. They are indoctrinated socialists that hate America and hate Americans." He said, "We need to be much more brutal than punching and kicking. This is not some simple street disagreement." And of course, regrettably, as we all know, horrifically, what he predicted, that is, Joseph Pavlik wrote on social media, came all too true. We had people who died on January 6th, horrific injuries suffered by law enforcement and others. Specifically, with respect to this particular complaint, the allegation is that Pavlik was a part of some members of this Three Percenters group, and they aligned in a faction called Group B, and they supposedly served as security for the protest that, again, was about the certification of the Electoral College vote by Congress. During the course of this review, the investigation of this matter, the charges were that Pavlik and five other group members joined a throng of rioters who were trying to force their way past a line of officers who were there at the Capitol. They were defending a place that perhaps many of you have seen if you've been at the United States Capitol. It's called the West Terrace Tunnel, and it provides fairly immediate and unobstructed access, some fairly immediate access to sensitive areas into the Capitol building. This Pavlik fellow, now a criminal defendant in the federal system, and five other members of this group had tried to push back, to force their way past this line of officers. That's basically the focus of the criminal complaint. He apparently said heave-ho a number of times as these pushes were underway, tried for hours to force the officers back, according, again, to this complaint. The attempt by these folks to gain access through the tunnel eventually failed, but that is not to say that the attempt was not made. And so that is the basis for the criminal complaint. Pavlik and others will plainly be called upon to answer for those allegations in the future, like the nearly 1,000 other people. And in that connection, we know that those other people, not just in Chicago, not just in Illinois, come from all 50 states in our country, in the District of Columbia, all of those charges coming from the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. We know as well that Pavlik, for what it's worth, is the 37th person from the state of Illinois, to be federally charged as a part of this ongoing investigation. So he takes his position among the ranks of these 1,000 people now charged and presumably going to trial. He could plead guilty or he could go to trial on those allegations. And it is that option, to either plead guilty or go to trial, that leads to our second story coming out just this past week in connection with another defendant in the January 6th case. And this fellow is named Thomas Adams Jr. We have spoken about him in the past based upon obstruction of justice and his attempt to assault the Capitol on that day. Well, this last week, a fellow named Judge Amit Mehta, the judge who's presiding over many of these cases in the district court in Washington, D.C., entertains a stipulated bench trial, which basically means that the parties agree on the facts, and the judge will therefore enter a finding based upon the things that they're presented. It's not quite a plea agreement, but it's pretty close. And in this particular instance, earlier in the week, Thomas Adams said, "Yes, indeed, I have done this, what's been charged in the complaint, in the indictment against me." And Judge Mehta said that, again, he will sentence him down the road. Well, what happened was that after Thomas Adams made that initial appearance before Judge Mehta and said, yes, I'm effectively going to plead guilty pursuant to this stipulated bench trial, what happened is that Thomas Adams went back to his home state, went back to Illinois once again, Springfield, Illinois, the state's capital, and he went into the media in that location and said, told the State Journal Register in Springfield, Illinois, this. He said, I wouldn't change anything I did. I didn't do anything, Thomas Adams said. I still to this day, even though I had to admit guilt in this stipulated bench trial, I don't feel like I did what the charge is. So in other words, days after admitting to doing something that plainly is in violation of the federal criminal code, for which he has admitted guilt in front of Judge Mehta in a proper court of the federal government, this fellow goes back and takes it all back, at least publicly. Interestingly, Judge Mehta finds out about this. And in a brief order, just yesterday morning, Judge Mehta said, basically, what's going on here? He gave both sides 1 week to provide reasons why the court should not vacate the defendant's convictions of guilt, as he said, in light of the defendant's post-stipulated trial statements included in the article. He attached actually a copy of the news report to his order, commanding both the prosecution and most significantly the defendant, his attorneys, and Thomas Adams in particular, to explain themselves. Plainly, he is unhappy with having taken this plea based upon the statement by Mr. Adams that he understands that what he did was wrong and that he was agreeing to plead guilty to enter into the stipulated bench trial heading toward a disposition. And the case is significant. We'll see what happens, what they submit next week, but it plainly underscores the hypocrisy and the convergence of what many defendants are saying in court as they are presented with and confronted by the specific charges, the possibility of their going to prison for long periods of time. We know some of those defendants have gone to jail as long as 10 years for their involvement. Again, some of those sentences imposed by Judge Mehta himself. But we know that judges hearing these January 6th cases in Washington, D.C. have been repeatedly and increasingly irked by defendants like this fellow for being apologetic and contrite in court, only to be making public statements days later. This seemed to minimize their guilt and sounding fairly cavalier about their actions. Judges are loath to accept what effectively amounts to a guilty plea from any defendant who doesn't sincerely believe in that guilt, and that's exactly what happened in this particular case. And so we'll continue to follow the case of Thomas Adams and Judge Mehta's response to what he feels plainly is a great disassociation between what Adams said in court and what he is saying publicly. More on that and other stories right after this break.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
The Devil's Advocates.
Today, I made a mental note. It was 1:09 Central Time when I found out Ron Johnson was a conspirator in a coup, a traitor to the Constitution, and Ron's been something of an apologist. You know, they seem real friendly. Well, maybe to you, Ron, because you were on the inside of the coup, and I've never made that accusation prior to today. So let's play it for the people.
This staffer stated that Senator Johnson wished to hand-deliver the fake electors' votes from Michigan and Wisconsin.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter. Suddenly, my quarterback is the number one trending topic. Why, you might ask, is Aaron Rodgers trending on Twitter? He's out this game. He's got COVID-19. And to my perception, he freaking lied to us, man. I'm very frustrated that he is not eligible to play this Sunday, especially when you find out your quarterback is a half a Trumpster. And he claims, I'm not a flat earther, I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I just play one in the NFL. That pisses me off, man. I was going to bet on that team. Maybe. New time, 3 to 6 p.m. And Dom!
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Highs around 34 this afternoon under partly cloudy skies. Southwesterly winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy skies expected tonight. Lows level off around 27. Cloudy tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 34. Temperatures a bit above average Monday and Tuesday with highs in the upper 30s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Hite. Currently, it's 16 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Once again, for joining me in this first hour of Morning Cannolis, talking about the important stories in law and government, the aspiration for justice in America. I promised at the top of this hour that we would get to at least four, if not five, other major stories of just this past week in that category. And indeed, let's start with the first of those. And that has to do with a federal appeals court. A federal appeals court, the Fifth Circuit, which is basically the South, Texas and Alabama and Mississippi, the district courts in those states, together form the Fifth Circuit. The Court of Appeals there is responsible for hearing reviews for challenges to decisions made by lower courts. And this past week, the Fifth Circuit, which is a notoriously very, very conservative court, I think anyone who reviews their decisions in recent times would recognize that, regardless of what side you are on the political aisle. Fifth Circuit, a very conservative court, and indeed lived up to that reputation just this past week. This very conservative appeals court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, one court below the United States Supreme Court, one court above the district court, the trial courts in those states, has thrown out, has found unconstitutional a federal law longstanding on the books. I used to enforce it as an assistant U.S. attorney and as a United States attorney, frequently used by current and continuing prosecutors in our federal system, a federal law that prevents domestic abusers from possessing firearms. And this particular court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, called the statute an outlier, that our ancestors, our historical ancestors in this land and perhaps others, would not have accepted. So what is this all about? Well, again, it's a panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit that ruled on Thursday, just a couple of days ago, in a case called United States versus Rahimi, R-A-H-I-M-I. And this is a significant matter. Again, it appeals, the appeal affects plainly the imposition and the invocation of this particular statute, which we're going to describe right now. Section 922 of Title 18 of the United States Code bars individuals, bars anyone in this country from possessing guns, firearms, if they are, quote, subject to a court order that restrains them from harassing, stalking, or threatening an intimate partner. Basically, domestic violence, right? You can't own a weapon, you can't own a firearm if indeed you are harassing, you're stalking, you're threatening an intimate partner. That's what the law says. Section 922 of Title 18 of the United States Code, in place for many, many years. So what happens here? This fellow named Zakay Rahimi became the subject of a February 2020 civil restraining order, okay, after his girlfriend accused him of assaulting her. Rahimi consented to the order, which prohibited him in this civil proceeding from harassing or stalking or threatening his ex-girlfriend and their child, and also significantly prohibited him from possessing a firearm. All of that done in February of 2020. Despite that restriction that was imposed upon him, he was involved in five Texas shootings between December 20th and January 2021. In one of those, he fired multiple shots into the residence of someone to whom he had sold narcotics. The next day, he was in a car accident. He shot the driver in the other car, fled the scene, returned to another vehicle, and shot the other driver's car. A few weeks after that, Rahimi shot at a constable's vehicle. And 2 weeks after that, he fired multiple shots into the air after his friend's credit card was declined at a restaurant. So this man is on a rampage, right? When law enforcement caught up with Rahimi while executing a warrant, they found a rifle and a pistol at his home, not surprisingly. And then Rahimi was charged in the federal district court with and convicted of unlawfully possessing a gun, again, in the wake of this domestic violence order. Rahimi challenged his conviction on the grounds that the law, the Section 922, was an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment, challenging something that's been in place for a very long time. And indeed, in the end, this three-judge panel in the Fifth Circuit agreed with him and said that, you know, the law is, in fact, unconstitutional. Who are these folks? There's a judge named Edith Jones. She was appointed by Ronald Reagan many years ago. And two appointees from former President Donald Trump. Their names are James Ho and Corey Wilson. Wilson took issue with what he described as the government's limited view of the Second Amendment's applicability. He wrote this. He said, "The words 'the people' in the Second Amendment means all members of the political community, not an unspecified subset. Rather, everyone in the national community," he said. I went on to explain that when the Supreme Court referenced law-abiding responsible citizens in its previous decisions, a case called Heller and one more recently called Bruin, it did not actually mean to allow states to strip individuals like Rahimi of their right to bear arms. So a very significant decision coming out of this three-judge panel. Court went on to say Rahimi, while hardly a model citizen, is nonetheless a part of the political community entitled to the Second Amendment's guarantee, all other things equal. And again, I mentioned this case just out of the last Supreme Court term called Bruin. It basically said that under the Second Amendment, we now have a constitutional right, believe it or not, to own and possess and presumably use weapons beyond our homes, beyond just for personal safety. And the panel basically said that under Bruin, again decided by the recent Supreme Court, gun regulations can only stand if they line up with historical analog. Again, this reference to the past as a way of understanding and imposing sentences and rules and laws in contemporary America. The panel, this three-judge panel, searched for some historical parallel, again, upon the invitation of the Supreme Court in Bruin, and it came up apparently empty-handed. The court rejected the argument of the Department of Justice that the English Militia Act of 1662 prohibited dangerous persons from keeping guns, and also some colonial regulations disarming disloyal individuals were similar enough to Section 922 to satisfy Bruin. And so they found the entire law unconstitutional, vacated this conviction, and found that indeed the case was improperly charged. Significantly, Attorney General Merrick Garland has sounded the bell on this. He said Thursday night this. He vowed to appeal the Fifth Circuit rulings. He said, "Nearly 30 years ago, Congress determined that a person who is subject to a court order that restrains him or her from threatening an intimate partner or child cannot lawfully possess a firearm." He went on to say, whether analyzed through the lens of the Supreme Court precedent, this Bruin case, the Heller case many years before that, or of the text of the law itself, the history, the tradition of the Second Amendment, that statute, the Attorney General said, is constitutional. Accordingly, he said, the department will seek the further review of the Fifth Circuit's contrary decision. And again, since this recent ruling of the Supreme Court in Bruin, multiple gun-related cases around the country have been testing the limits of this precedent, involving New York cases, D.C. cases, including things over this sensitive location. That coming out of the Fifth Circuit just this past week, a stunning argument coming from the Court of Appeals. We'll see what happens down the road. Stay with us for further discussion of the rule of law here in America in our second segment on this morning, February 4th, 2023.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces. Just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.